Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Continuing with chapter 2, the wheel of birth and death. And this section is called the user's manual, the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha outlines the spiritual malaise, that means the illness, suffering, dukkha, as the first noble truth. He says that this dukkha is to be recognized, to be apprehended, to be understood. But it's also notable that the Four Noble Truths is laid out like a medical diagnosis. So you have, first of all, the symptom, dukkha, that's the how the disease appears. And then the second is the cause, the origin of the disease. Then the third noble truth is the prognosis, is it curable, which is fortunately yes. And then the fourth is the treatment. And so people have written or theorized somewhat, particularly Kalupahana, who is a Buddhist scholar and writer, that there was this format in the Indian medical world at the time, and the Buddha took that format and applied that to his spiritual understanding. Others have said, no, the Buddha came up with this, and then the medical people followed along afterwards. And so there's been scholarly debate, as they say, about which came first. But anyway, it's helpfully put into that form. So symptom, cause, prognosis, and treatment. So it starts off with dukkha. That's the symptom of the spiritual disease, of the fact that we are less than totally happy all of the time. And then as we chant in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Buddha's first discourse, then when we're doing the whole Udapadi section, Chakkhum Udapadi, Jnanam Udapadi, and so on, then with each of the four truths, there is a way in which those truths are to be worked with, that is spelled out. So dukkha, the task involved with that that first noble truth is parinyayanti. It is to be recognized, or to be apprehended, to be understood, or to be accepted. Parinyayanti, or to be studied, really, also. The second noble truth, again, this is a very, very brief summary, because there's lots about four noble truths in many other books, particularly Lumpo Sameto's wonderful little book. The second noble truth, the cause of that spiritual illness, is outlined as self-centered craving, or desire, tanha. The Buddha encourages us to work with this second noble truth by abandoning that cause. It is to be let go of. Pahata Bhanti, that's the Pali for that. The third noble truth is the prognosis, that this malaise of dukkha can be cured, so that it's that's the possibility. Yes, there can be an ending of that dukkha. Dukkha Nirodha, there's the possibility to be free of dukkha, and that cure, the freedom from dukkha, is to be realized, Sacchikata Bhanti. And the fourth noble truth is the treatment. The Noble Eightfold Path is the medicine that will bring about the cure from the malaise of dukkha. The Buddha's advice is that this Eightfold Path should be developed, Bhaveta Bhanti. In a sense, the teaching of dependent origination spells out in fine detail how to get from truth number two to truth number three, and from the cause of suffering to the end of suffering. I often compare the teachings to a car's manual. The manual may be 100 pages, but you can also have a one-page summary in the front that tells you what you need to know to get your car to start and to drive it. That one-page summary is the Four Noble Truths, the other 99 pages in the manual are the teachings on dependent origination. They are like the detailed instruction in the car's manual about how to control the heater, how to adjust the air conditioning, or the settings on the lights and the indicators and the automatic doors. It explains all the fine detail of the system so that the driver will know how to adjust everything in order to make full and effective use of the vehicle and also look after maintenance and so on and so forth. So the sequence that you have in the Four Noble Truths, you've got symptom, cause, prognosis, treatment, in terms of a time sequence, and this is something that one of the great Thai forest Ajahns has pointed out and made much of, Lumpur Duan. In terms of a time sequence, the time sequence really goes 2, 1, 4, 3. So cause of dukkha, the experience of dukkha, the treatment for the condition, and then the result of that treatment being applied. And so Lumpur Duan had his own way of expressing the Four Noble Truths in that order, and saying, the cause of suffering is the mind getting lost the cause of suffering is the capacity of the mind to get lost in its moods, and then the experience of dukkha is fully being lost in a mood, being born into a particular mood, and then the mind knows itself, then that is the way that leads to the end of suffering. And when there's the actuality of the mind being aware of itself, then that brings about that ending of suffering. So he, in his writings, in a number of places, and he talks about this reconfiguring and reframing or restating of the Four Noble Truths. And Lumpur Samato was very, very fond of this, and I believe at his kuti, I don't know if he's got the copy here, but at his kuti in Ratanawan Monastery in Thailand, he had this written out in Thai script, sort of, I think, carved onto a sort of a wooden tablet in Lumpur Duan's very succinct expression of the Four Noble Truths in that 2-1-4-3 modality. Any questions, thoughts, reflections? Yes.
So, in terms of that little summary, there was these times when uninvited person that they're not suffering. Their mind's aware of itself. Mm-hmm. But then there's the total destruction of the taste, which is kind of the complete end of suffering. So. I'm not sure what the question is, but just reflecting on, kind of like on a day-to-day level, some moments we're not lost, then we get lost again. Mm-hmm. But then what kind of makes a difference to get to the point where actually you're kind of totally not lost all the time?
When mindfulness is unremitting, when there's an ongoing awareness of this is a feeling, this is a thought, this is a sound, this is a memory, this is a mood, and that the mind is not, there's enough mindfulness to appreciate the field of experience and perception and know that none of it is a person or belongs to a person. That appreciation and that framing of the flow of experience and perception and feeling in a non-personal way. It's still there, and it's over and over again. And you can see that the stories of accounts of the enlightened beings having conversations with each other, walking around, getting ill, and doing things, and making choices. There's still the Buddha and the other enlightened beings are certainly doing things and engaging. So the sense world is still functioning very actively and ordinarily. It's not that you see things in a particular way or hear things in a special way. But there's no self-creating around that field of perception, and then on account of that, then there is because of that continuous presence of mindfulness and full awareness, then there's a sensitivity to the time, the place, the situation, the limitations that you have or the capacities that you have of this being in relationship to the environment. that they are in. So that's what makes a difference, like the mind knowing the mind. And that is a way of talking about having sati, having mindfulness, and whether it's a wholesome thought, an unwholesome thought, or a neutral thought, whether it's a agitated emotion or a peaceful emotion, whether it's a busy state of mind or a focused state of mind, then it's in knowing all of those as they are. Okay, in the teaching on the four foundations of mindfulness, the third one, Cittanupassana, I think it's very significant that when the Buddha's talking about establishing mindfulness around moods, he doesn't really distinguish about whether wholesome or unwholesome or comfortable or uncomfortable. Knowing the agitated mind is agitated, knowing the unagitated mind is unagitated. Knowing the mind with anger is the mind with anger, knowing the mind free of anger is free of anger. It's completely flat. It's like there's no value judgment about that in that instance, whether there's an agitated feeling or a peaceful feeling or concentrated or scattered, and just knowing at this moment the mind is scattered, at this moment the mind is focused, at this moment the mind is expanded, at the moment the mind is contracted. So that and at the end of the section it says the establishing of mindfulness to the extent of knowing there is this, you know, that is the way that mindfulness is fully established. So the challenge, you know, so maybe when we're sitting still in the temple and we hear a sound and the mind, and everything is very, very still and quiet and steady, and, oh, here is my mind calling that sound bad, or the mind saying, you know, I don't want to hear that. And it's very clear that it's just the thinking mind having a reaction to a particular sense perception. And there's no identification or attachment. But then when you're out and about and sort of being a person, then it's much more easy to be drawn into that. So the effort is really sort of establishing that quality of mindfulness and full awareness of what Lumpur Samedha would call intuitive awareness, the sati sampajanya, and sustaining that as fully as possible through a day. Yes?
But I suppose there's a speculative question, at least for me, but somehow that awareness is accompanied by sort of, I don't know how to say it, feeling of sort of brightness, but you are aware of things, but at the same time not. Where I'm going with this is because there is, in the diagnostic manual, there is such a disorder called dissociative disorder, you know, several dissociative disorders. Mm-hmm. One of them is called depersonalization. Mm-hmm. And how people describe it is that they sort of everything, they feel removed from everything, they are aware of everything, but it all feels weird. Not real, but not in a, I don't think there's a kind of depersonalization as people describe anatta, or deep realization of anatta. So, that sort of quality of awareness comes with, I don't know, engagement, not rejection of the world, being aware of it, but being uniform, you know. Did you have something to say about this?
Sure, yeah. I mean, there's quite a number of quote-unquote meditation diseases or difficulties that arise either from meditation or just in terms of how the mind is functioning. Sanya vipalasa literally means the incorrect holding of perception. And so, or the vipassana upakilesa, the defilements of insight. So sometimes that their, you know, effort can be made and there can be that kind of letting go or distancing, but if it's held in an unskillful way, or if there's still subtle attachments to self-view in the background, or there's subtle kinds of rejection, then that can have its effect, and you get these dissociated states where people are just sort of walking out in the middle of the street, and it's a real spacing out, or the mind interprets it, oh, I'm the only real human being in the world, everyone else is just phenomena. Yeah. And so those are all imbalances or to do with the wrong, the sort of mistaken holding of perception and experience. And so it's one of the reasons why living in a sangha and having in a community and having people sort of experienced people around or having resources that you can check in with. So if the mind starts to go in those directions, then you can think, well, this is what I'm experiencing. You know, is this in balance or out of balance? And so it's one of the very helpful aspects of living in community is you've got to, or people looking at you saying, are you all right? You say, I'm fine. Really, really fine. Yeah. Let's have a cup of tea. You know? And whereas, you know, if you're on your own, oftentimes it's people who are sort of practicing by themselves or living in isolation, they can get further out into those dissociated or lost in those states because they haven't got a mirror or they haven't got someone close up that can tell them, you sit down, let's have a cup of tea. But no, I had that, that kind of experience as a teenager of falling away of the sense of self. And it was very unsettling and extremely unpleasant. Because I didn't have a context what was happening. I was looking in the mirror. I wasn't hallucinating. It was this face, well, with hair and a beard, but I wasn't hallucinating, but that face in the mirror had absolutely nothing to do with this quality that was looking in the mirror. Like, there was no connection. So that was extremely weird and very unsettling. And I think I did take refuge in putting the kettle on. That's a very, very British thing to do. It's like, okay, this is extremely weird. I don't know what to do with this. Have a cup of tea. You know? And so for about a month or 6 weeks, it was interesting because I had this strangely certain intuition that, you know, you're not crazy. And don't go to the college doctor. You know, you can handle this on your own. You're not crazy, but and just stay with it, and things will shift, which they did. But it was very, very unsettling. But then it was a couple of years later when I'm in a monastery and I've got a context of Buddhist practice and teachings on not self, then having a very similar experience on a solitary retreat, it's like, oh, right, well, this is great, because I had a framework for it. And that same sense of looking in a mirror, like, well, what's that got to do with anything real? That's just this appearance. But that which is knowing the sensory perceptions of a human life and a face and so on, like, How is that knowing, which is completely formless, really absolutely connected or identified with the form that's there in the mirror, or looking at my hand? Again, not hallucinating or just with distorted vision or anything, but just that sense of this is not who and what I am. But then the mind held it in a very, very different way. I feel that's one of the great benefits of having, the possibility of living with other fellow practitioners and having great teachers around, like Lumpur Someto was incredibly helpful and as a sort of resource of wisdom and guidance in those years for myself. So it's those kind of distortions of perception. And if you look at the list of qualities, like the vipassana upakilesa, the defilements of insight, there can be things like unremitting mindfulness, abundant energy, radiant states of mind. You can read through it, well, that sounds pretty good. But the way the mind is holding it, often there's a kind of intoxication with those states, or that there's an identification with this, you know, I am this. And so that's the kind of, even though they have wholesome qualities to them, they don't lead to anything peaceful or really liberating. They're kind of energized and have a sort of maybe a rapturous sort of joyful quality or an energetic quality to them, but they very easily lead to being out of harmony with the people that you're in, or looking after your body, or just acting in ways that are sort of confusing and painful for yourself and the people around you. So, to continue. When we look at the dependent origination teachings, particularly considering it as describing cycles of addiction, there is a specific... Oh, sorry. Let's go to the next page. Yeah. Yeah, that's right, excuse me. When we look at the dependent origination teachings, particularly considering it as describing cycles of addiction, there is a specific question to investigate. Why do I keep making the same mistakes? Why do we keep repeating activities when we know they bring suffering? Why do we keep indulging in certain obsessions? When I talk about addiction, I don't just mean addiction to alcohol or cocaine or nicotine. There can be addiction to meditation. There can be addiction to your iPhone. Addiction to relationships, addiction to fame, addiction to self-criticism. It can be subtle or gross, it can be visible or invisible. When I speak about addiction, it can refer to many different dimensions of experience. Each one of us can usefully look at our lives and see the areas where we get stuck. So that was just a follow-up to the earlier comment, and the that... understanding how dependent origination and these teachings work, where the different dimensions of the mind gets caught up, whether it's a tangible addiction or something that's much more subtle in terms of relationships or how you see yourself, or your own life, your own mind, it can vary. So there's an encouragement to take a look and see, well, what are the areas where my mind really gets caught up? What does the mind like to get born into, even if what it's born into brings pain and difficulty? Sometimes we can continually create trouble for ourselves just because it results in the feeling like there's a me who's having this trouble, and the purpose of is not conscious, is not deliberate, but often what causes the mind to keep making those same mistakes, I would say, is that it can feed the sense of I and me and mine, me who never gets things right, or me who's who's got this particular ability, or me who's always being rejected by other people. That it's probably more common habitually create painful situations than it is to create pleasant situations. I would say a bit of a sweeping statement, but. And looking at the human world, it's often that way. And I'm reading it and read how that works. It's often just the sense of self that comes from that. Just looking for an argument, looking for something to complain about, just so that you'll feel about there's a me here who's got a thing that is existing and a thing that's wrong. So that sometimes when things are peaceful and easy and comfortable, the mind is just hunting for something to contend against or complain about or get upset about or worry about. I often use the example, because I was a very compulsive worrier. An example I often give is, so you're carrying out some task and you're involved in some sort of activity, say tidying up a place, and you finish the job, everything's tidied up, you sit down and go, okay. The job is done, nothing to do, and then there's a few seconds of the out-breath, and then there's a kind of a discomfort, what am I doing, what's going on? And there's a kind of scanning of the things, that the room around you, or the other responsibilities or activities, and then you suddenly remember, oh, I've got to write, all those emails I've got to answer, or that person I've got to talk to, and then even though it's another duty or another thing, another responsibility, there's a, oh, thank goodness, there's a relief that you've got this thing to exist in relationship to, And that even though it's an extra responsibility, there's a relief that there's a me that exists in relationship to that, whereas that undefined sense of being. And so often we create problems just to get away from that experience of undefined being, I would suggest. But we'll get to more of that as we go along. In order to assist this investigation, I'll briefly describe the process of dependent origination and how it relates to addictive habits. Once again, some teachings about dependent origination speak of it as referring to a period of three lifetimes, past life, present life, and future life. Other representations refer to present moment experience. When I describe dependent origination here, I'm taking the second approach. I'm simply referring to this present moment experience that we have here and now. So, dependent origination links 1 to 4, avicca, sankhara, vijnana, namarupa. To begin with, when considering the momentary approach, it's important to talk about the fundamental nature of mind, original mind. It's one way of talking about it. To describe this, one uses terms like suchness, tatata, but there are also other descriptions. This is from a Tibetan teacher, Kenpo Tsultrim Gyamso Rinpoche. So this is from his book, Progressive Stages of Meditation on Emptiness, and it was translated by Shenpen Hukum, who's a very experienced translator from Tibetan into English. And this is from there's five different stages in that book. It's a very small book. It's not a very common publication. You don't see it around very much. But this is in the fifth or the most sort of refined section called Shentong. The luminous, self-aware, non-conceptual mind that is experienced in meditation, when the mind is completely free of concepts, is absolute reality and not a vijnana, Pali vijnana, a partial, fragmented knowing. When the luminous, self-aware, non-conceptual mind that is the wisdom mind is realized, there is no seeing and seen aspect, no realizing and realized aspect to the realization. It is none other than the non-conceptual wisdom mind itself. It's also called the non-dual wisdom mind, the clear light, prabhasara, prabhashvara, nature of mind. In Pali that's prabhasara, the dharmata, and the tathagata garbha. Tathagata garbha means the womb of the Tathagatas, which means the origin of the mind, the origin of awareness. Now, when we talk about ignorance, therefore, even though it's situated at the beginning of the classical 12 links, we're not talking about it as the basic nature of reality, but rather that ignorance is something which arises from original mind, which is the mother and father of everything, as Ajahn Chah's teacher Ajahn Mun liked to put it. Ignorance and all perceptions of everything arise in contrast to that basic ground. Dependent origination is thus talking about the arising of illusion out of reality. So in particular, in the little collection of Ajahn Mun's teachings called Mutodaya, then he makes that point. It wasn't done from a recording. It was one of the Sangha members who was present for that. So the teachings which sort of took notes and put them together in this little book called Mutodaya, or The Heart Released. Ajahn Tanisro has done a translation of that. And in that, one of the points that Venerable Ajahn Mun makes is that everything has a mother and father. Ignorance has a mother and father, and the mother and father of ignorance is original mind. And the tie for that is jit-dham. Jit is the citta, the heart or mind. Dham means original or source. So jit-dham is a term that's fairly common use amongst the Thai forest ajahns. This principle will be explored in more detail later on in the book, in chapter 6, when the, quote, third exit point from the cycle, unquote, is described. Dependent origination is thus a way of looking at what happens when the natural awareness of mind is clouded. When there is ignorance, the mind doesn't see clearly, ignorance being represented by a blind person or by the blind leading the blind in the first image on the rim of the bhavachaka, the wheel of birth and death. When we lose our mindfulness, this gives rise to sankhara. Sankhara means divided or particular, or that which is compounded. Sang means together, like the word sangha is a collection of people, a unified assembly. Kara is from the verb to make or to do. So sankhara means literally sort of made together or put together, hence compounded. So separate things compounded together, or conditioned compounded qualities. It means the arising of self and other, any kind of polarity or duality, so that out of this mind which recognizes suchness, we start to drift off to the sense of self and other. Sankhara also means thingness, the world of things. That's hence sort of compounded and formed. Thus the illusion of solid independent entities starts to arise. What we then have before us is a process of crystallization or complexification, so that fundamental sense of division into this and that becomes strengthened and conditions vijnana, which means discriminative consciousness. The mind is not only just dividing this from that and self from other, but it's starting to be able to conceive a whole variety of different elements, different things within the sphere of attention. The first four of the 12 links are avijja, sankhara, vijnana, and namarupa, ignorance, formations, consciousness, and mind and body. These four links refer to the establishment of the subject-object relationship. When there's ignorance, just to remind people that ignorance in the Buddhist use of the term is literally not seeing clearly. So the word jnana in Pali is related to the English word gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S, or the Greek, it's also a Greek word, gnosis, gnostic, ig. And so the ngo of ignorance, I-G-N-O-R-A-N-C-E, that's not knowing. So that we take ignorance in the ordinary English usage to mean not having some information, but it's so the its literal meaning is like not jnana, not aware, not the mind having a clouded sense of knowing or awareness, or distorted, clouded, or unclear, incomplete sense of knowing. When there is ignorance, when the mind does not see things clearly, then the mind drifts into the sense of a me here and a world out there, quote unquote. Initially in a rudimentary way, as formations, sankhara, then strengthening into consciousness and mind and body, vijnana and namarupa, in relationship to each other, leaning on each other like two bundles of reeds, as it says in the Sanghita, which I'll read in a minute, section 12, sutta number 67. Thus, at this stage, the division between subject and object, a knower and a known, seems quite real and natural. Vijnana leans on namarupa, and vice versa. So the vijnana leans on namarupa, and namarupa leans on vijnana in a reciprocal relationship. It's an intensification, helpfully referred to as the vijnana-namarupa vortex by Venerable Nyanananda. The mind is drifting into a sense of separateness of the experiencer and the experienced. And Venerable Ruchiro, I think you were asking the question yesterday about that. So I thought to read the bundle of reed, or bits of the bundle of reed sutta. Also, the Namarupa Vijnana vortex is mentioned in Venerable Nyanananda's book Concept and Reality. This is a really very helpful book about conceptual proliferation, Papancha. It's also mentioned in his book called The Magic of the Mind, and also in his, he has a series of 33 lectures about Nibbana, so it's also in a couple of places in there. He's not an easy read. He's Sri Lankan, but his English is extremely accurate, but not particularly easy to read. It's very scholarly, sort of academic English, so you have to kind of be patient. But it's also extremely helpful because he brings in all the Pali, so you can look directly at the Pali originals as you're going through his translations and his own commentaries. So just briefly, I'll read a part of this sutta. So this is sutta number 67 in the Nidana Sanyutta, the collection of teachings, collected teachings about causation. Nidana is causation. And this is a dialogue between Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Mahakutita. They were living in the deer park at Isipatana, which is where the Buddha was first met with his five companions shortly after the Enlightenment. So it seems like Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Mahakutita were back living there for some time. So in this dialogue, Venerable Sariputta says, "Name and form, Namarupa, friend Kotita, is not created by oneself, nor is it created by another, nor is it created both by oneself and by another, nor has it arisen fortuitously, being created neither by oneself nor by another, but rather with consciousness as condition, name and form comes to be." How is it, friend Sariputta? Is consciousness created by oneself, or is it created by another? Or is it created by both oneself and another? Or has it arisen fortuitously, being created neither by oneself nor by another? Consciousness, friend Kotita, is not created by oneself, nor is it created by another. Nor is it created both by oneself and by another, nor has it arisen fortuitously, just by chance, that means. Being created neither by oneself nor by another, but rather, with name and form as condition, consciousness comes to be. So, and now we understand the Venerable Sariputta's statement that name and form, friend Kutita, is not created by oneself, but rather, with consciousness as condition, name and form comes to be. Now we also understand the Venerable Sariputta's other statement, consciousness, friend Kutita, is not created by oneself, but rather, with name and form, as condition, consciousness comes to be. But how, friend Sariputta, should the meaning of this statement be seen? Well then, friend, I will make up a simile for you. For some intelligent people here understand the meaning of a statement by means of a simile. Just as two sheaves of reeds, like two bundles of reeds, like a long stiff grass, as two sheaves of reeds might stand leaning against each other, so too, with name and form as condition, consciousness comes to be. With consciousness as condition, name and form comes to be. Then with name and form as condition, the six sense faces come to be, and so on, to the dependent origination. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. If, friend, one were to remove one of those sheaves of reeds, the other would fall. And if one were to remove the other sheaf, the first would fall. So too, with the cessation of name and form, comes the cessation of consciousness. With the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. And then with the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of the six sense spaces, etc., etc. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. And so Venerable Kotita was very impressed and happy with that. So that's an image. Also, it's reflected in that, in the Mahanidana Sutta, in the long discourses, where it said, that consciousness and Namarupa, it turns back upon itself, they condition each other. So it's the same basic principle of those two leaning on each other or affecting each other, supporting each other, is described. So before I carry on, and I realize this is subtle and a difficult territory to get one's head around, but yes, Lindsay.
Is this original nature the same as Buddha nature?
It depends who you talk to. I would say it's closely related, like the Tathagata Garbha, the origin or the source of the Tathagatas. So that. I know that Ajahn Tanisaro doesn't like the word Buddha nature. He is one of those things. One of those terms. He's sort of made a lot of critical comments about. But I personally, I feel that it's very close to that, or similar to that. Just as in that short statement from that book, Kenpo Tsultrum Gyamso gives a number of names. So this is called the non-conceptual wisdom mind, the non-dual wisdom mind, the clear light nature of mind, the Dharmata and the Tathagata Garbha. So you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different names just there in one paragraph. So that quality of awakened awareness. I also like the term vijja dhatu, the element of awareness, that I feel is a very accurate and helpful way of term to use for that same quality.
Ajahn, would you say that in Theravada?
Lindsay was about to follow up with something.
Okay, I'm sorry.
She looked like she was breathing in to say something.
The reason why I find it important is because when you talk about original nature, Buddha nature, it seems to imply there is a certain kind of entity, existence, even though the cessation of the dependent origination is realized. But there is something higher, something more sublime that is beyond.
Well, also the Buddha nature is that awareness that knows these different patterns taking shape, it's a term that's sort of been used a lot over the centuries. But it's also the reason why we use the word Buddha to refer to the great teacher. It's because that's how he talked about himself. There's this dialogue between him and the Brahmin Dona, where this Brahmin sees the footprints in the dust, and he sees these remarkable patterns in the form there in the footprints. And wow, who do these footprints belong to? This is some. They look like large human footprints, but they've got these wheel shapes and these different patterns there. And it describes him then following the footprints off through the dust into the forest, and then finding the Buddha sitting under a tree. So then Dona comes up to the Buddha and respectfully addresses him, and he's plainly amazed by the radiance and peacefulness of this being that he's encountered. And he says, "Excuse me, venerable, are you a deva?" And he says, "No, I'm not a deva." "Are you a Brahma god?" "No, I'm not a Brahma god." "Are you a yaka?" He says, "No, I'm not a yaka." "Are you a human being?" He says, "No, I'm not a human being." I mean, that's a brief way of stating it. So that whereby you could know me as a human being that has been abandoned and cut off. And then Dona asks, "Well, so what are you?" And then the Buddha's response is, "Buddhosmi," so that you can, I forget the exact wording of it, but it's essentially, you can know me as, you can refer to me as one who is awakened, or that which is awake, Buddhosmi, Buddha meaning awake, aware. And so that's one of the reasons why we use the word Buddha to refer to the great teacher, is that when he's asked the question, "Are you a human being?" he essentially says no, even though he's born from a human mother and father, and there's a human body. That the mind, that whereby there could be identification with being referred to as a human being, that's been cut off at the root, made like a palm tree stump, deprived of the conditions for existence, and rendered incapable of arising in the future. But still, there's a dialogue between these two people in the forest. And so that Buddha quality is what's speaking. And so that which knows the patterns of dependent origination, or that which knows the quality of peacefulness and clarity and freedom, that quality of knowing is the, I would say, is the Buddha mind, or the Buddha nature.
Ajahn, could I just say something about the Buddha nature? Because I been involved with Tibetan Buddhism for a long time, and took Kathachakra and Dalai Lama. I know that the Buddha nature is thought to be something fundamental to everybody, and there is that idea that everybody can become a Buddha, basically. My understanding is it's not exactly the same in Theravada, so there is a Bodhisattva who will become a Buddha, but not everybody has a Buddha nature, and then not everybody will become a Buddha. So, of course, in Tibetan Buddhism, you have hundreds of Buddhas, and people worship different Buddhas, like Vajrasattva, Kalachakra, there are so many. So do you think these are? We can put these two
parts. Parts are compatible. Parts are not compatible. So in the Pali Canon, there's no suggestion that all beings will be enlightened. Like, if you do the right thing, you'll be enlightened. If you don't do the right thing, you won't. Like, so that teaching that you get from the Lotus Sutra, all beings will become Buddhas, that's not found in the Pali Canon at all. Like, what is found is that if a being does the necessary and realizes the Dhamma, then they will be liberated. If they don't, then they won't. So it's not a kind of some golden age messianic teaching of like, you know, we'll all end up in Nirvana eventually. It's like, no, samsara is endlessness if you do the right thing. So it's more challenging, but I feel it's more realistic and more mature myself. But I would say that one of this quality of awakened awareness, I would say that beings born in the human realm, that we all have access to that, whether there will be a debate whether animals or other creatures have access to that same quality. But I would say it's a fundamental attribute of nature, and as a human being, that we all have the ability to access that to some degree or another. But some of us choose to access it and clarify that, and some don't. So I would say that potential for enlightenment is there in the human realm in particular, but definitely not that all beings will be enlightened one day. That's not, and that just doesn't make sense to me anyway on a personal level. So anyway, Lindsay, is that?
I think it's a very interesting question. It's like enlightenment. I think it's a different interpretation between Northern School and Southern School, where it's like, I wouldn't say everybody can be enlightened, but probably your attention is more close to Buddha nature exists in everybody if you can reveal it through practice.
And so, and also, I think it's helpful to demythologize it. Mm-hmm. It really just means being awake. So that capacity to be awake and to be aware, oh, this is a sound, this is a feeling, this is my mind saying I like, I don't like, this is the mind saying I understand or I don't understand. That quality of awareness that can know the present experience and know it as an experience, that's Buddha nature. It's not remote or mysterious. It's being awake. In Russian, I believe the word for an alarm clock.
Budin.
There you go.
So wake up, somebody is to budit.
So wake up. Evgenia, time to go to college. So that it's not something that we need to think of as sort of remote or out of reach, but it's often sort of buried under all of our busyness and activity and our self view, but we have that capacity, and that. So often, when we use a sort of language like, you know, Buddha nature, it can seem sort of far away and sort of remote or something very, very special. But it's, I would say that when the Buddha said, you know, mindfulness is the path to the deathless. Like, when there is mindfulness, then there is an accessing of that quality. Jyotika, you had a question.
In the simile of the reeds, if I'm understanding, it's an explanation more than if the conditions for consciousness are there, then name and form also arise. It's not necessarily a teaching about how to break that link in dependent origination, or is there any pointing to that in there?
There could be, in that, if there, as the Venerable Sariputta says there, if one bundle is pulled away, then the other collapses. So, if there is insight developed into the nature of Nama Rupa, and say this Nama Rupa, These five khandhas, they're empty. They don't belong to a self. They're not a self. They don't belong to a self. They are intrinsically empty. If there's enough mindfulness to see that, like say the teaching of the Buddha beside the river at Ayodhya, when he talked about the lump of foam, you know, rupa is like a lump of foam, perceptions are like so feeling is like a water bubble, perceptions are like the trunk of a banana tree, the sankhara is like a mirage, and vijnana is like a conjuring trick. So if there's enough, mindfulness and wisdom to recognize, oh, that the five khandhas are intrinsically empty. They're not a self. They don't belong to a self. Then that letting go of the substance of the object, then the substance of the subject falls away as well. So, or it could be if there's in using the meditation to reflect on the feeling of the quality of anatta, and that it's sort of focusing on this isn't a person who's thinking or hearing. There's hearing, there's thinking, there's feeling. It's not a self, it doesn't belong to a self. So then the subject side falls away, and that would sort of empty out, or that would disempower the solidity of the object. But so with that, I mean, there's different ways you can relate to it, but I feel that the sort of sankhara, the kind of forming seed, and then strengthens into subject, object, an experiencer, and an experienced. Or like in that Kenpo Sutram Gyamso, the realizing and the realized, or the seeing and the seen, the seer and the seen, that is made more and more solid the more the mind invests in that, the vortex strengthens. I'll continue a little bit. Here we go. This is subtle territory, so I appreciate it's not easy to follow, but it's all good stuff, as they say, I would suggest. There are many ways that this process can be understood using the terminology of dependent origination. One useful framework is to take the vijnana bundle of reeds, quote-unquote, to be embodying the formation of a subject, whereas the nama-rupa bundle of reeds embodies the formation of an object. If one is already somewhat familiar with Buddhist teachings, this might seem a bit confusing. And this, I did debate whether I was going to put this in the book or leave it out, because it's a bit fussy and can make things even more confusing, but I left it in eventually. So, if one is already somewhat familiar with Buddhist teachings, this might seem a bit confusing, since vijnana is also part of the group of mental qualities that make up nama. So, nama-rupa, because rupa is material form, and the nama part is vedana, sanya, sankhara, vijnana. So, hence, and people do ask about that. How is this? How do you get vijnana and then nama-rupa? How does that work? So, how can vijnana be both part of the subject side as well as the object side of the process? To help make sense of this, I would suggest that the vijnana, that is the third link in the chain of dependent origination, refers more to the subjective faculty of cognizing, knowing, whereas the vijnana, which is the last of the factors of comprising nama-rupa, the fourth link in the chain of dependent origination, refers to the finest grained units of experience that make up any sensory event, so part of the object world. Just as in a picture taken by a digital camera, at high magnification, it can be seen that the picture is composed of pixels, tiny individual colored units, so too the vijnana, that is one of the five khandhas, which means the same as nama-rupa, refers to the pixels, or building blocks of experience, that comprise every sense object. Thus we have a single word having two related but variant meanings. This is not uncommon in Pali, the word sankhara being another example. So the reader and practitioner needs to be wary of making assumptions that they know what a specific word means. Mindfulness of the context and a lot of reflective consideration will always be helpful! That's the best I could do. I went over and over that a few times to try and both talk about it, but also how to explain it without people going, huh? It's even more confusing and muddy than when I started. But if you are interested to get a sense of that, you can go over it a few times and make your own pencil marks, draw a few boxes and arrows between them, and work it all out. Because also you've got Salayatana, the six senses, you've got Namarupa coming at that, you know, Vijnana Namarupa. So Namarupa is the fourth link, and then you've got Salayatana, the six senses, and contact at number five and number six on the list. And then you've got Vedana, which is also one of the five khandhas, at number seven. It's like, So it can be confusing. But one of the purposes of this little book was to help people to appreciate, it can be confusing, but if you work with it and you sit on it, reflect on it, then slowly but surely things do take shape. Yes?
I have a question on Vijnana. That's a khandha that...
Is what?
That's a khandha that's confusing to me at the moment. Maybe because of the English translation, and when I think of consciousness and the connotation, it's quite hard to parse it apart from awareness. So consciousness, awareness, wakefulness, and from what you just read, my clarifying question is, Vijnana, it's like a self-referential knowing. So it's not the kind of knowing that leads to liberation, it's the kind of knowing that creates the self. Maybe?
In terms of the five khandhas, I've been so back and forth over this for many, many years. So that description of it being, it's more the discriminative consciousness or what distinguishes one thing from another, that's the basic function of Vijnana, and say the building blocks of experience. So, because, you know, even say this is Rupa Khanda is material form, but the only way that material form is known is through touch and sight and sound, which are made up of, you know, eye consciousness, ear consciousness, touch consciousness. The only way that those different aspects of the other five khandhas can be known is through different patterns of consciousness. So that's why the Vijnana, which is sort of number three on the list, I tend to think that is the knowing or cognizing element. The Vijnana that's part of the five khandhas is more like even though it's the same word, it refers to the building blocks of experience, the pixels that make up sound or seeing or color or sensation, that literally the bursts in the different sections of the brain that say this is eye consciousness, ear consciousness, touch consciousness. That, because, you know, I don't actually experience this book, I experience my mind's representation of the book. If my fingers were numb, that signal would not be there. I'd hear the sound, but if I was deaf, I wouldn't hear the sound either. So we don't experience the world, we experience our mind's representation of the world. So what makes up that representation is the building blocks of the Vijnana that's part of the five khandhas. And then the quality of knowing or cognizing, that anyway. So that in that respect, I see that Vijnana in that usage is referring to the realm of the object. So all of the five khandhas are in the realm of the object. Like seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, feeling, thinking, remembering, and so on. And then there's the quality of knowing those objects is that a different kind of consciousness. The people have probably written PhDs and such like about this, but that's how it makes most sense to me over many years of exploring all this. Does that make sense?
Okay, more sense.
You can say no. If it's, it's all right. It's all right to say no. But I think I'll leave it there for people to sit on for a bit. 7 o'clock has come around already, so I think I will leave it with mindfulness of the context and a lot of reflective consideration will always be helpful. Also, I need to say what I put in this book and my own comments on it. This is not sort of definitive or the only what's the one and only way to understand it correctly, but over sort of 40 years of exploring this all and looking at it and also having to teach it, describe it, and use it as a sort of a framework for understanding this mysterious human existence, then that's the kind of languaging and format that makes most sense to me. Okay? We'll do that for today.
Andamayangam Ovaligataya Sadhu Kurandadama Se
Sadhu Sadhu Sadhu.